The XX Gab Fest is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron sends gourmet recipes and all the fresh ingredients you need to make them right to your door. To see what's on the menu this week, visit blueapron.com. And our listeners get their first two meals free. Just go to blueapron.com/XX. That's D-O-U-B-L-E-X. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, September 15th, the Real Women Edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, writer and editor at Slate. I'm in the DC studio and I'm joined in New York by Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
And today we are excited to be podcasting with Amanda Hess, who is a writer for Slate. Hi, Amanda.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. June is away doing big June-ish-like projects that no doubt involve teeth, which she will tell us about when she comes back, because June's all about the teeth. Before we begin, I want to, as usual, read a letter from one of our listeners. I did say that we were going to compile a playlist for Noreen, and in fact, many of you sent in fabulous music to work by. I just haven't had the time to compile the playlist yet, but I absolutely will. It was wonderful. There's a lot of great music in there, so Noreen will be happy and be able to work for 1 million more years once I get that going. But in the meantime, I'm going to read from Joy Meads. It's relevant to one of our subject together. She writes, "I enjoy the podcast, but with troubling regularity, I become aware of the awkward clash between the Slate counterintuitive take and a woman-centered podcast. Sometimes it feels like you guys are spending so much time not saying the thing you think is expected women's take that you actually wind up waxing expansive about points that reflect the regressive male point of view." That's harsh, right?
Wait,
do you
like
feel
what?
Harsh on?
Like
okay,
what?
Okay, Gillibrand. And we will get into this in our I chose this letter because for the first time we're having like a broad feminist discussion, which really we have avoided all of these years. So Kirsten Gillibrand, our discussion about whether the word harassment even applies here. She writes, "According to the EEOC, harassment is unwelcome conduct that is based on race, color, religion, sex, national origin, age, disability, or genetic information. And yet we refuse to accept that and had a lot of dismissive language about how it's like a cute story for her to tell and it's grandpa stuff. So can you really take it that seriously?" She's you know, parroting our point of view here, that we are so dismissive of the idea that Kirsten Gillibrand was harassed, which is what a lot of people in the culture thought. So, Noreen, do you feel chided or do you feel defensive right now?
I don't think I said that Kirsten Gillibrand, I guess I'm defensive since I'm retreating into my position, but I don't think I said that she wasn't harassed, but I can't remember. I have a terrible memory.
I remember.
What did I say?
Well, Hannah and June, I think, were arguing that it wasn't a big deal, and you thought that it was.
All right. So I can be confident in my defensiveness.
Yeah, I'm sure I was the worst offender, and I'm sure I'm always the worst offender on this topic, which we will get to in our feminism topic. But I would say, you know, unwelcome conduct is a hugely broad definition of harassment, I guess. That's what I would say. And I think I would also say that Gillibrand did not necessarily herself define it as harassment, and I'm not sure if that's relevant or not. But let's not get into that whole discussion all over again. Okay, our topics for today. First, football player Adrian Peterson accused of child abuse. Is corporal punishment ever acceptable? Second, has feminism conquered the culture? This week's New Republic takes on this great debate, and we will pile on. And third, the phrase, a real man. Is there such a thing as a real man? What does he look like? What should he look like? And is there an equivalent real woman? Our first topic, Adrian Peterson. Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson was indicted in Texas this week for beating his 4-year-old son with a tree branch. In statements to police and text messages to the boy's mother, Peterson consistently and calmly defended himself. He said he didn't really go overboard or lose his control. He was just using the switch, as he referred to it, to teach the child a lesson. "Anytime I spank my kids, I talk to them before, let them know what they did, and of course after," he told the police. But the child himself and the injuries to the child tell a different story of something like abuse. The incident has reopened the debate about whether corporal punishment is ever acceptable. I thought before we launch into the actual discussion of this, I would read what the reports say the injuries actually were. So the beating allegedly resulted in numerous injuries to the child. I'm reading this from local Texas reports. Cuts and bruises to the child's back, buttocks, ankles, legs, and scrotum, along with defensive wounds to the child's hands. And then Peterson texted the mother saying that she was going to be mad at him about the boy's leg because he got it kind of good with the tail end of the switch. Amanda, since you wrote about this, I will start with you. What was your view about the whole affair and whether it constituted child abuse?
I think from a legal perspective, it's kind of unclear. But from a moral perspective, I don't understand how it's legally unclear. We shouldn't be able to hit kids, I don't think, with in any amount of strength with anything. But I think we're in sort of a strange position now with this event, especially coming after the Ray Rice scenario with the NFL, where after the video of Ray punching his then fiance came out, we had all of these women who were victims of abuse coming out and talking about the dynamics of it and why it's important to take it seriously. And with the Adrian Peterson case, like, we don't talk to kids, you know? So it's sort of unclear to me, like, on a cultural level, how we're going to advance from this point.
Well, it seems like there's universal agreement that men should not hit women. And added to that fact, there was horrible video of Ray Rice and his now wife in that elevator. But plenty of people who are not, I would say, are not abusive parents do spank their children. And so this exists on a spectrum in a way that, like, domestic abuse does not exist on the same spectrum, you know?
But should there be a cultural allowance for that conversation? In other words, that there is a spectrum in which corporal punishment is on one side of the spectrum and perfectly acceptable, and many, many, many people believe in corporal punishment as a parenting method, and then child abuse is at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, I think absolutely.
But that's a controversial thing to say. Like, not a lot of people who wrote about this.
I'm just taking
you know,
that
allowed for that
slaty point of view.
But what's your real point of view? I'm really curious.
That's my real point of view, which is that I think, I'm not a parent. Which is just like my blanket disclosure that I feel like I need to say before I opine on any child rearing techniques, but. I don't, if I have kids, I don't think I would spank them, but I also don't think someone is abusive for lightly spanking their child over their pants like once a year, right? Like, I don't think that actually, I mean, maybe a psychologist would disagree with me, but it seems as if in studies, what Ray Rice did is has very, very different effects on a child than Adrian Peterson. You disagree with me? You think that all spanking is equal?
Me? No, no. And I, this is my problem. Like, Peterson's intent and his frame of mind is relevant here. We are treating it the same as domestic violence. I'm not saying what he did was okay. Anytime you send your kid to the hospital or even to the doctor, you have some serious soul searching to do. Like, even if your belief is in corporal punishment. But there is a pause when you hear Peterson describe himself what he thought he was doing, and he describes it in a methodical way. It is not a kind of out of control hitting of a child that I associate with child abuse, you know? Mm-hmm. So then you have to sort of back up and say, you know, if we immediately call it child abuse or violence, I think you can't really have a conversation. He thought he was implementing corporal punishment, which he believes to be a method. I'm not saying it was okay, but is the question you should have, should Adrian Peterson go to jail, or does Adrian Peterson need to have a serious soul searching about his parenting methods?
Well, what he said that I was very struck by was he was very focused on the word discipline, and that the discipline mm-hmm. he had received as a child had made him the man he is today. And I think it's pretty common to sort of wake up as an adult and think, okay, these things that I chafed at as a kid that my parents were doing were actually very good. And for me, it wasn't being beaten with the Switch. It was like not being allowed to watch TV, right? Like, that's different. But there is this idea that you have been through this crucible and you are happy with the product and you're trying to instill it in your child. Now, I don't agree with the method at all that Adrian Peterson used, or really that Adrian Peterson's parents and probably his parents' parents, like, this is something that appears to be handed down in his family that I think is just awful. But the idea of instilling discipline in your child, particularly to someone who has a career like the NFL, which is, you know, to be an athlete is to be a person of supreme discipline. And that discipline is often physical. And so I can understand the mindset that he's coming from, even though I think, you know, the end result is awful.
And you mean awful because the child is bruised up?
Awful, yeah, awful because this is a 4-year-old kid you're hitting with a torture device. Like, it's just the act of it in addition to the result of it, I just think is so different than lightly spanking your child.
Yeah, I mean, Will Salatan wrote a very interesting piece for Slate about his own childhood in East Texas, where in the public schools, corporal punishment was still legal at the time he was going. And he pointed to many studies about what's called the hidden curriculum, which I thought was interesting. This idea that no matter what you say the hitting is for, what the child absorbs, this is the hidden curriculum, is the hitting. You know, they're not listening to any words you say. They're just hearing blah, 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 blah. They're not listening that this has a purpose. They are experiencing the being hit. Mm-hmm. And they're absorbing that. And then that comes out in the future in different ways. You know, hitting is acceptable, shame, whatever. You know, so the hidden curriculum in the case of physical violence is far more powerful than anything that it's designed to accomplish.
Amanda, why don't you believe that any child should ever be spanked?
I guess I don't understand why we need to hold on to that. What is the purpose of hitting a kid, even if it's symbolic, you know? I don't think that's a symbol that we should be teaching our children is, like, effective in relating to other people.
Right.
I think, you know, when it comes to putting someone in prison, obviously swatting a kid on their butt and leaving cuts on his scrotum are very different, I think.
I guess, you know, where does my resistance come from? I guess it's this idea that there is so much class-based child rearing at the moment. So, you know, even this idea that you have to talk to your children X amount of times per minute. I mean, it seems like we are so, because corporal punishment is fairly common among lots of people who are not necessarily the upper class elite child rearing. So we're putting out there this idea that the way that we raise our children, which is we talk to them, we explain to them things, is the only way to raise children. Now, maybe that's true. I don't know. I mean, there is a huge amount of evidence which shows that positive reinforcement, whether your child is violent, autistic, a toddler, completely neurotypical, or whatever, is the one thing that works. I mean, that's what research seemed to show. You ignore a bad behavior, you reinforce good behavior. But again, I don't know if that's like a culturally based science that just is always reinforcing what we elite parents like to do. So it's hard for me to just completely wholesale dismiss what lots of people do over many generations and think is a good idea.
Yeah, I just, as a total observer of this, I think a lot of elite children are not well-disciplined, to be honest.
Right.
And I don't think that necessarily means, or I do not think it means you need to spank your child, but I think a lot of positive reinforcement is inexpertly applied, and the result is that the children are just a little bit out of control and indulged, personally, as
right.
an observer from the sides.
Right.
Sorry,
so,
elite parents.
Noreen, it's okay. Noreen, to put you on the spot for
sure.
A minute, if you could define, and I remember reading a lot about this in the Christian literature, so I thought about it many years back, if you could define how one would, if one were to correctly use corporal punishment. Now, I couldn't bring myself to do it, but let's say one decided that it was effective at some level as a last resort to hold over as a threat to the child or whatever,
mm-hmm.
keep them in check. What would it look like?
Like, physically? Like, what would the...
Yeah, literally. No, just what would the whole... I mean, I can answer the question if you don't want
to. I know.
To.
I will tell you an example from my own childhood, right?
Uh-huh.
So I was spanked as a child. You guys can all put me on the shrink's couch now, but like not a lot, right? So the one incident that like really like in my memory stands out as the time I was disciplined as a kid was, I don't know how old I was, like 6 or something. And we were on a family vacation driving in a mountain somewhere, like up a steep mountain. And I was in a really bratty stage. And, you know, I'm one of 6 kids. So we were all in the same station wagon. I was in between my teenage brothers. And I was just like throwing a fit and like creating a problem where like my dad, you know, it was this really windy road. It was really dangerous that there was a small child throwing a fit. So pulled off to the side of the road, like this whole production where I had to get out of the car and I was spanked. Not hard at all. Like, you know, just like essentially a tap. And it was definitely the shaming in front of my whole family that they had to stop this car because I was the problem here. Like I was bringing down the family, you know, situation in an actually dangerous way. So I think it probably was, and my mom is going to kill me for talking about this, but like, I don't think that my parents were out of line there. Like if I had actually, you know, my parents had driven off the road because I was being a brat, you know, that's not good.
And did they talk to you? Like, did they explain to you why you were being spanked, or was there words?
Oh,
like,
yeah. No, my parents were very like good about that. Mm-hmm. So they did. I mean, I don't remember what they said. I was 6, but I just remember I have no memory of the actual like physical thing. I just know that I had done something so bad. Like this is like the worst incident of my childhood that I had, you know, my parents had to stop the car, you know?
Right.
So maybe Amanda's right. And it is actually just the act rather than what is said to you that you remember. But like, I think you God, I'm going to get in trouble for this. But like, I do think that like the idea, and I'm not saying that you have to inflict this idea via corporal punishment, but the idea that there are actual limits to what bad behavior is allowed, like that is an important thing for you to teach your children. And it seems like a hard thing to teach your children. And probably parents, when they resort to spanking, only do that in like really their own limits have been tested, right? Like they just don't know what else to do.
Well, Hannah, I'm wondering how you impose that with your children if you don't spank them.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I you know, in some ways, I tell you, the appeal as a parent is that it's the end of talking, right? Like that you spend, we as elite parents and, you know, all this research which shows the number of words you share with your children up to a certain age, it's like words, like talk to them endlessly, talk to them in their stroller. And I think the appeal of something like a spank is that there's no more talking. Like we've reached the end of the talking and the bargaining and the negotiating and the positive reinforcement and the good job. That is it. There are no words that are appropriate for this situation and your behavior. So this is where we have all landed. And so, and you know, those moments should be extremely rare, but probably extremely memorable. Like I remember the one time I was spanked as a child, as you do, Noreen. It's like a very vivid memory because it was like, that's it. We're done talking to you. You know, you're no longer a person who can be reasoned with. Like you've crossed some line, and this is the symbol of having crossed that line. So, you know, I do timeouts and I do this and I do that, but then I really lose my temper and I like scream or whatever. You know, that's not that
yeah,
useful.
Yeah, is screaming worse than spanking? Like,
I think screaming is at least like an activity that you can carry on into adulthood. Like if I am at the end of my rope with someone, I cannot like bend them over in the office and spank them. But maybe we'll go into their office and raise our voices. You know, I don't know. So I'm very skeptical of the idea of being able to do something physical to a kid that you're just not allowed to do to anyone they leave your house.
That's a really good point, is that are all actions you're teaching children as a child things that you want them to carry over into adulthood? Now, you might be teaching them that there are points when you just can walk away or, you know, it depends what talk you give them before the spanking. Like, what is this about and what's the lesson you're going to draw from this? But it's true. You can't take that with you. I mean, you can have like angry sex with some. I mean, there's ways you can do it, but like not with a colleague or a friend, like only in very limited circumstances.
But there are lots of things you do in child rearing that you, I mean, children are not adults and you don't always relate to them as you would other adults. I don't know why I've become the spanking apologist here. Probably all goes back to that incident in the car. But
yeah. 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 No, I see the appeal. It was a little, you know, that the conversation went straight to child abuse without the conversation that we're having in between, I thought was, you know, it was too fast. It's like you had to have a conversation in between there. Why do lots of people use corporal punishment and what is it for? You know, which, as I said, is in a lot of Christian books. When I was covering the Christian right, like all Christian books about child rearing or marriage have a chapter on when you spank and how you do it and how you talk to your child and when it's appropriate and all that stuff. You know?
Well, it's something like 70% of Americans spank their children.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
89% of African Americans.
Yeah.
So Charles Barkley had this whole response to the Adrian Peterson incident where he was like, yeah, that's culturally like not surprising.
And 70-30 is the college split, by the way, right? Like that's you. I bet you're dividing there between people who went to college and people who didn't. That's, I bet, the 70-30.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of it is people just responding to their own childhood and not believing that the way other cultures raise their children can be as good as the way they themselves raise their children, which is both the spankers and the non-spankers feel that way. It's one of these issues that everyone is like really has an opinion on. Few people are like, I don't know, I could go either way on spanking. It just seems like harmless.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. But, you know, that's not to say I wouldn't want to sometimes. All right. Enough of that. Let's move on to a second topic. Has feminism conquered the culture? But before that, I want to thank our sponsor, Blue Apron. Now, we had some confusion about the Blue Apron ad last time because a couple of listeners wrote us, were extremely interested, which they should be, but didn't quite know how to get to our site. So I will do this more slowly. Cooking and eating should be fun, but stuff gets in the way. You're busy, you don't actually know how to cook, or it gets too stressful, and you just order out or eat cereal. So what's the answer? Blue Apron, they do all the hard stuff for you and leave you with the fun. They come up with recipes, send you the exact ingredients, and give you idiot-proof instructions. Okay, so listen to these recipes. They are so fancy, I can barely pronounce them, and yet they are easy and take half an hour to prepare, like furikake topped salmon. I may need some Brooklyn help here. Or summer vegetable hayashi chuka, or curry tofu, or chili dusted chicken. Anyway, you look at the pictures, they're beautiful. You can make them for $9.99 per meal, which is also ridiculous. In its cheapness, they'll send you the right ingredients in the exact right proportions with simple recipe instructions right to your door. Meals are delicious, fresh, and only 500 to 700 calories per serving. As I said, cooking takes half an hour. Shipping is always free, and they never send you the same meal twice. So you can see what's on the menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com and it's /XXGabFest. That was the confusion last week. Was it double X or GabFest? But it is double X GabFest. So that's blueapron.com/ and spelled out DoubleXGabFest. So start cooking incredible meals with blueapron.com. Okay, let's move on to our second topic. This week, a cover story in the New Republic asks whether feminism has conquered the culture and features a debate between two of the smartest feminist writers out there, Judith Shulevitz and Rebecca Traister. Here on the podcast, we have for years avoided zooming out that far on the big question of feminism. And I think we've even avoided talking about feminist blogs. But the time has come. So we ask, thank you, ladies, for appearing for this moment. I know this is going to be a hard one, but we'll do our best to rein it in and not, you know, talk about waves and more waves and end up in the 1920s. We'll do good. So is this a new wave? And if so, what in this wave do we care about? So I'm going to start by just framing a few of the arguments. Rebecca Traister cites as proof Beyoncé, Sheryl Sandberg, Tina Fey, and just as importantly, a proliferation of feminist websites as evidence that the great debates are alive much more so than at any other point in her life. And Judith Shulevitz, in her first volley, says, too much of online feminist conversation bounces around in a giant echo chamber. Now, I would say there's not a generational difference between these two. Judith is a little older than Rebecca, but they are more or less, I would say, the same generation of feminist. So why don't we start with the online feminism conversation? What do you guys, as readers of feminist blogs, as people who have written for feminist websites and blogs, what do you think is the deal with the online feminist conversation? Is it getting better? Is it at its best? Is it really productive and healthy? Or is it a lot of people just calling each other out for, like, who's more, you know, does it just feel PC wars to you?
To me, this moment feels very PC wars, and I did not feel that way maybe a year or two ago, and certainly not in 2007, 2008, 2009, sort of in there. For me then, maybe this was just me sort of discovering internet feminism then, but those years felt very exciting to me. Things like Jezebel and Double X were starting, and they felt like you could could express feminist views that took us the same bedrock notions without sort of having the orthodoxies policed. And now if you say anything that is not sort of chapter and verse, you know, of this very particular vision of what feminism is, you are a traitor to the movement. But to me, I'm not exactly sure what the online movement in this moment is asking for, other than that correct language be used at all times.
So what data points? Like, why do you think that's true? And if so, why do you think it's happening? And either one of you can answer that. Amanda, you can disagree, but I'm just curious why people have this sense that we're in this police orthodoxy, like, mini moment, micro moment.
Well, I don't have great examples at hand. I think a lot of the discussion on Twitter, you know, when this our third segment is about this discussion of real manhood, right? And someone, so Obama, we'll get to it, but someone says something that is interpreted as being in some way anti-woman, and then everyone chimes in to express the ways that it is anti-woman. And I'm not saying that sometimes these things are not. But I think there is something happening online generally where, more than moving towards something, people want to identify as part of something. Like, having a distinct identity online is very important to people now, whether that is means like taking a BuzzFeed quiz about like 26 signs you're from Ohio, or if it means like being part of a feminist listserv. I think just looking at this huge maw of the internet that brings the whole world together and being able to like pick out a little tribe for yourself is very important. And I think feminism has become a really prominent tribe there.
So what you're saying is you think the online feminism conversation, just because of the way online conversations happen, creates niche. So you have to like belong to one niche or belong to the other niche and then kind of police the boundaries of that niche. It's just something that an online discussion encourages people to do.
I think so. I think so, especially in this moment when everyone just wants their content to be shared, mm-hmm. and getting people to identify with something or to be really against something makes it more shareable.
Gotcha. Amanda, as someone who has written so well and for such a long time for feminist blogs, what do you think?
I agree with Noreen. I think it's the online feminist conversation, which I think is sort of a funny thing. It's sort of like, what happens to the online feminist when we all close our laptops? Like, do they disappear? But it's like a lot of other online writing, and I think maybe feminism or women's writing is sort of unfairly diagnosed with this when it really is a problem that's affecting, I think, a lot of people who write about a lot of different topics. But there is a lot of rhetoric and not very much reporting because we don't have money and we don't have time. And the easiest thing to kind of do is to take someone else's argument and add value by disagreeing with it, or to take, you know, a news event that's being covered in 300 other places and kind of plug it into like a sexist Mad Libs sort of piece. And it's not that it's wrong, it's just that it's like so dull a lot of the time. And I think
yeah, that's totally
Jezebel in 2007 was like exciting and surprising, and it seemed like like Jezebel itself as an entity was sort of like an expression of feminism, that we could have all of these sort of like interesting female writers like writing about their lives and the culture and politics. But now it seems like just sort of an exercise in like explaining feminism, which is quite boring.
But you don't do that. I mean, neither one of you ever writes like that. So
on my worst days, I do that.
Yeah, I've done
on my best days, I don't. but
you mean you just get lazy and you do the Mad Libs and you're like, this is sexist. You know, it is sexist that not enough women were included in X or Y or
I try to avoid the calling myself lazy, but I do think it's like it can be a calculation. So I do the Mad Libs and then I can make phone calls sometimes. I really think it's time and money.
I see. That just the structure does not allow you to kind of carve out your own space and take some time and kind of discover new things. But because when you're reactive, it's more interesting to be, or it's more successful or effective, I would say, to be just very reactive in a certain way that people recognize.
Right. And also I have way more resources than most people who are engaging in these conversations do, many of whom are not compensated for them at all. So I think that sort of helps explain why the level of discourse can be really reactive and also sort of boring.
But don't you also think there's something sisterly in the way that women care so much and in the way that people sort of identify with feminism and the intense debates and are really committed to them and, you know, just care a lot? Like, that's the world that I feel slightly out of because I'm not built like that. Or something. I don't know. I'm not a joiner. I can't really fully explain what the temperamental problem is. But I do admire it. Like, there are people who care so much and are really invested in these debates and the state of women, and that community exists online and that occasionally rises up in beautiful moments like supporting Wendy Davis. Or, you know, there are just moments when it comes together like a sort of beautiful hive mind around a certain issue. I mean, I think it's just kind of a lovely thing to watch, this kind of light activism that sometimes gets heavy and hard and good.
Yeah, and I think particularly, I mean, both Amanda and I live in New York, where probably a lot of people share our worldviews or adjacent worldviews to ours. But if you're living somewhere where maybe it's a little bit harder to find a community like that, I can imagine this being really important to you. I guess maybe one question I have that I think Judith raises in her essay, and I think Judith was actually a little too dismissive of online feminism, although I share some of her problems with it. But one thing she raises is, like, what are we actually asking for with this? Like, do we have a list of demands? Is it enough to sort of get feminism to be a cool thing? Will that sort of propel us towards a better future by having Beyonce at the VMAs post pole dancing, standing under a big banner that says feminist? And I'm not entirely convinced that just having more people say that they are feminists will actually get us towards real legislative change, which was sort of Judith's point. But nor do I think it's a bad thing that, you know, we've gotten Taylor Swift and Beyonce to call themselves feminists. That is like the major thing that online feminism has accomplished. We got Taylor Swift to be a feminist.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. So, I mean, I think, you know, legislative change is one thing, but I often think, you know, if Rebecca Traister is right, and this is a distinct, you know, we feel the wave coming, like people will look back and remember, oh, my gosh, there was Sheryl Sandberg, there was Beyonce, like, there was just this moment, there's this triumphal moment and these intense debates happening. I even wonder, like, what will they be culturally defined as? You know, so you're right. Okay, that would be sad if it was just Beyonce. but you know, there's the other option, which is the kind of lean in moment. You know, will it be remembered as that, as the woman finally making the final hurdle in sort of corporate culture?
Which
would
is
be
not,
a little sad too.
Yeah, which is not something sad. I identify with. Nor is it something that I think a lot of online feminists actually identify with, but they feel like they can't. I don't know why I'm making the distinction between on and offline feminists, but nor is it something that I think a lot of people who are involved in this movement or just believe in this movement identify with, but they feel
why
like...
Why not, though? Why not? I mean, you're a working person. Like, you want to get a decent salary. You want decent working conditions. Like, I'm a person with children who would like, you know, for my sort of my life that I need to live to be given some, you know, credence. I mean, I'm not saying you have to agree with what Sheryl Sandberg says, but if it's a moment of sort of relative success and lots of women in the workplace, like, maybe that makes some kind of sense for it to be for this wave of feminism to be about our engagement in the public domain, you know, not as voters as it was in the 1920s, but like as working, living people.
Yeah. I mean, I just think Sheryl Sandberg is sort of a neoliberal tool of the patriarchy, but but like I'm not supposed to say that out loud because she, you know, is a feminist figurehead, and you know you can't like the worst thing that can happen to a movement is that it, you know, has these internecine squabbles and it fractures and then you get nowhere. But I think Sheryl Sandberg is really like a corporate warrior, not a warrior for women. That's my personal point of view.
Yeah, I think this the phrase that the New Republic uses, feminism has conquered the culture, I think you could look at it that way, or you could look at it as like capitalism absorbing feminism. And maybe both are happening and we're meeting somewhere in the middle where we are holding up these capitalist structures because they're like giving us a shout out, and I'm not sure, like, I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, know? They are giving us shout
out. They're giving us shout outs, like... and it's like, I guess I appreciate the shout out, but also the shout outs are so, they're kind of weird. Like, when Taylor Swift at least identifies as a feminist, one of the reasons that she does so is because she's learned that the definition of feminism means that men and women are equal. And it's like, what does that even mean? It's such a low bar. And so we have all of these people who now can identify as feminists because they think men and women should be equal, but they're not even clarifying, like, if they think that's happening now, like, if we've accomplished that, or like what we need to do to make that the case.
And one of the things I liked about Judith's portion of the essay was that she called for sort of a rebranding of what feminism is. For this is kind of a clunky term, but caregiverism, like just the idea that essentially there will be structures put into place in American life for you to have a family life in addition to a work life.
Yeah, I mean, I love Anne Marie Slaughter, and her book is going to come out soon. And at least I've been on a couple of panels with her since, and she has shifted from this idea of, you know, can women have it all, to this more broad idea of caregiverism, not even just for women, but for men in general. And it is kind of it is a clunky term, but it's a gentle term because it's less about kind of succeed, achieve the way Sheryl Sandberg is, than about this notion that we are whole human beings. You know, it doesn't even have to be like me and my kids. It can be, you know, of yourself, of your parents, of your relationship. Like this idea that if this is moment is about women entering the workplace, then let it be about us remaking it a little bit rather than just, you know, joining it as it exists, which is that, you know, people are human beings. American capitalism hasn't really recognize that in all of its years of advancement. You know, many other countries recognize that there's like a human life being lived by workers, and we don't. And so it's a radical idea in a way, I think.
Damon Linker for The Week's website wrote what I thought was a very interesting response to this essay, where he argued, or maybe sort of approached arguing, the idea that what we're calling feminism is actually just liberalism, that liberalism has sort of lost its way, and all of these things that we are saying we want as feminists are really just things we want as liberals, and that like it's very hard to be a non-liberal feminist because there's not room for you. Like, we don't think of, you know, Sarah Palin as being a feminist. I don't think she would self-identify that way, right? But like, they're, you know, we sort of have dismissed, like, you know, pioneer lady feminism in favor of this very specific, or that is just what has become the culturally dominant version of what a feminist is.
Okay. So did we do okay on our big, bad feminist conversation?
I don't think we offended anyone too badly. I don't know. Maybe.
Did we get out of control?
I hope we offended someone. I hope I get some angry tweets. Can't wait.
Yeah, at least a few. Okay, let's move on to a related but lighter topic of real men. After the Ray Rice domestic violence fiasco, Obama gave a speech saying, "I want every young man in America to know that real men don't hurt women." real men don't hurt women. This trope came up recently after the kidnapping of 300 Nigerian girls when celebrities and activists got behind the real men don't buy girls slogan. That was a great one. Like, who does buy girls, you know? Anyway, it's like two other people. It's okay. Other people buy girls. Oh, boy. So it's time for us to ask, what is a real man? What does he do? What does he not do? And is there a Barbie to his Ken, i.e. who is a real woman? What is a real woman? Okay, so did you guys look up the real men lists like I did? Is that the first thing you did, like look up BuzzFeed's real men list? I was trying to figure out like what the culture thinks a real man does and doesn't do. So the only thing I could think of was like listicles, you know?
Did you find any?
I did. There's like a million out there. There's like the Good Men one and the BuzzFeed one, and there's the AskMen.com one. And they're essentially like, it's weird. They're very knee-jerk. It's always like the opposite of what used to be. I mean, it's like, have you, like, a real man, this is the Ask Men list, a real man keeps his house in order. There are no pizza boxes sitting around, no undershirts on the floor. You know, it's like, it's, they're very feminist. A real man takes care of his appearance. A real man a real man keeps his promises.
This is, you know, like Ladies' Home Journal from 1955.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a real woman does, I don't know, it just, they're so gender neutral. Huh. And then the BuzzFeed one is like, a real man knows how to pet a cat. That's number one on the BuzzFeed list. And
is
a real man knows...
Is there wrong... Have I been petting cats the wrong way?
Like,
yes.
You've been petting them like a woman.
Like a woman.
Like a little girl.
Oh my God.
But a real man pets his cat like a woman. That's what's confusing about these things. Like, a real man knows how to show his son that it's okay to be different, you know? So that's very confusing because, right. I don't know.
So yeah. Fake men are just more traditionally masculine.
Fake men are like in the military. So like a real man, another one of the BuzzFeed lists is fake man knows they don't have to, I mean, a real man knows he doesn't have to fight a war to save a life. You know, there's a picture of him, like, taking a kitten down from the tree. I'm not sure about that, but it's something in that category, you know.
So dramatic.
So real men are basically not real men. Like, not what we have previously. It's, like, very Orwellian, you know. A
right.
real man is not a real man.
It's interesting to me that it's framed as a real man as opposed to a good man. And I know there's some good men framing, but that seems to be what they're saying. Like, this is what a good man will do. He'll pet a cat this way. He'll save it from a tree. He won't hit his kids, etc. And I'm not sure why. Is it just that the idea of being a man is so central that it doesn't really matter, that it's important to go beyond being a good man or a bad man and say, if you do this stuff, like, you're not even a man anymore at all. You're not even a bad man. You're not even right. allowed to be a man if you do this
yeah.
stuff. It's confusing to me.
Well, I think it's just... people in our culture see the words good and man as being synonymous with each other, so it feels repetitive to say the two in a row. But I think I intended to come on here defending the concept of a real man, although these BuzzFeed lists are annoying the hell out of me.
But which real man? Are you defending the old-fashioned,
no.
like, a real man as opens the door for a lady and a real man, you know, keeps his promises and a real man as a leader? Is like, is that the image of real man that you have in your head? Or is it, you know, pet a cat and wear a Superman costume so your son knows it's okay to wear funny costumes and then implication, you know, be gay or something different in his life that we, you know, we didn't used to define as real man.
I think that those are not that different from each other. So I guess I'm just going to defend the rhetoric of it. You know, someone like Obama coming out in the wake of the Ray Rice incident and talking about that. I think what someone like Obama is responding to is this idea in the culture that, so you, like a beer ad or a truck ad, you know, has this very pumped up version of masculinity that connects to a much older idea of masculinity as connected to aggression and protection and all these sort of more violent notions are just sort of, I think, have been divorced from the actual. I just think that there is sort of this false masculinity, like the trappings of masculinity without any actual good human characteristics attached to it, right? Like I'm not saying going to the gym is bad, but you go to the gym and you get huge muscles, but in service of what? Like, not, you know, not doing anything in particular, just sort of, yeah, looking
Susan
better.
Faludi Susan Faludi and Stift has a great term for this, which is ornamental masculinity. You know, that we came to this moment where, you know, there used to be noble values associated with manhood, and then we sort of and then men's place in society became confused. This book was written in the 90s, but and then we were stuck with what she calls ornamental, meaning like things you see in TV and the movies. You look a certain way, just what you were saying, Noreen, like you work out in the gym, you do these certain actions, but they're disconnected from any meaning or structure in your life, you know, from how you are in your family or in your workplace or with your friends or whatever. They're just like an image, you know, with no content.
And that can bubble over into very bad versions of what a man should look like. And I think what someone like Obama is saying is that no, and the reason he's making it gendered is because there is something gendered about domestic violence. He's just responding to the situation at hand. But I think like being a real man is not that different from being like a real human or a real woman, which is just being like kind and strong without being violent. I don't know. I don't think that we need to like just knee-jerk dismiss the rhetorical formulation of real man in this circumstance.
I just read cultural panic in it. Like, why are men, why is it so hard for them to let go of this idea of what a real man does or doesn't do? Like, it really has not been that hard for women over the years. Like, over the century, women change a lot, you know? I will wear pants. I will go in the workplace. I will not stay at home to take care of my small children if I don't want to. I will hire babies. Like, women can shed things really, really quickly, and men just get stuck, you know? Like, we talked about this before. Show the crises of masculinity that reappear every some decades, and you know, now we have them you know, with all the great TV characters like in Mad Men and in Breaking Bad and The Sopranos, you know, where you have these men kind of in a permanent crisis of masculinity. Like, get over, you know, a century of crisis of masculinity. You know, it just, I feel like, move on. You know, a man does whatever the hell he wants to. Like, we have to hang on to these concepts. Would any of your, I mean, could you, I guess you could have a BuzzFeed list that says a real woman. Like, is there a female equivalent? A real woman does what? Is it just the opposite? A real woman, you know, brings some, I don't know, what would it even be? This feels like an 80s thing with women that we've gotten over.
Right. Well, when you talk about women who are sort of more flexible, what you're talking about is women doing things that used to be male things. So they're putting on pants and they're working. And as I guess we've established, like, male things are good things. So it's easier for women to do them. Whereas for men to reach some sort of equilibrium and to get them to stop using their strength for hurting, they need to act a little bit more like women. And I think that's something that we can't say out loud. But so we say real man instead of like making it obvious that it's like a more feminine approach.
Yeah, but that's a really important point, because I've written about this in my book. There are these personality trait tests that people have taken over, you know, 40, 50 years. And women have over those 40, 50 years described themselves as characteristics that used to be considered traditionally masculine, you know, a leader, dominant, aggressive. And men have like backed off traits that were feminine. It's like femininity has become more threatening over the years, or anything nurturing, anything associated, despite all of the flowering of like stay-at-home dads and, you know, all the things that we talk about all the time. Somehow it is very difficult for men to embrace things that as a deep part of their identities that have been defined as traditionally feminine. And maybe that's all of our faults. Like, maybe, like you said, Amanda, it's because we persist, like, feminine things are still lesser and undesirable in some way. Like, we're transmitting that without necessarily being conscious of it.
I do think that you will occasionally see people using the formulation like real woman, but it's more sort of three-dimensional in some ways. Like I, to bring up Beyonce again, like, people will be like, she's a real woman. Like, and it means, you know, it means sort of like strong and tough, but also feminine. Like, it, and there's a maturity associated with it, which I guess there's a maturity associated with saying real man too. But I would never say to myself, like, in my head, you know, okay, be a real woman about this, Noreen. Like, you know, I'm not sure why. I would say be a grown-up or something to myself. I do think that, like, thinking of myself as a woman and not a girl is something that happened at some point in my 20s, and that brings a whole set of traits along with it that are aspirational for me in the way I live my life. And so maybe it's just semantics that we're talking here.
And do you think there's some sexism in that, the fact that you won't say Noreen be a real woman? Or do you think that's egalitarian and as it should be? Like, men also should not say to themselves, be a real man. They should be like, grow up.
Oh, I'm sure there's some sexism in that, internalized sexism. Mm-hmm. I can't quite explain what it is, but there's just be a real woman. That just sounds to me like I should, you know, put on like a dress and a pair of heels, not like, you know,
right,
get excited for the workday or something. I don't know. Just I would reach for the phrase man up before I would reach for the phrase like be a real woman about this.
It's the opposite of man up, woman down.
Woman down. Woman down for what? Yeah.
I always think about it as options. Like, you should be able to choose from a menu of options of things that were traditionally considered, traditionally, I add, masculine or feminism without that much penalty. Like, if you choose to be one of those, like, dominant women, the woman who just doesn't feel like being nice or reaching out to people or, you know, saying things in a communal way, good for you. Like, that's who you are, you know? And if you're a guy who is, by nature, very nurturing or has what are considered traditionally feminine qualities, good for you, and you shouldn't pay a penalty for it. You know, there is my idea. Idealized universe.
I think we're kind of moving towards it. The BuzzFeed lists seem like a real turnoff. You know,
right.
Like they,
yeah.
They just seem like they are doing more harm than good in moving towards that idealized future.
Okay, so let's do our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I want to recommend a book called Women in Clothes that came out a couple weeks ago. It's a collection that was pulled together by Sheila Hetty and Heidi Julewitz and Leanne Shapton. And it's sort of photographs of women's clothing and women just talking about what their clothing means to them. And if you care about clothing but are not interested in capital F fashion, like the fashion industry, like you just care about what you think about your clothing, you care about the way you present yourself to the world, this is a really thoughtful and enjoyable look at that.
Yeah, I saw the press release. I'm so excited for that. I mean, I just love everything Sheila Hetty does, so I'm excited to read it. But
it's visually striking and it's bite-sized without being thoughtless. It's fun.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to recommend a book by Catlin Moran called How to Build a Girl. She is hilarious. People shorthand refer to her as the British Tina Fey. She's a columnist in the UK. And her book is about how to build a girl. It's like a story of a teenage girl that grew up very much like she grew up. You know, working class, dropped out of school to become a rock critic, has many, many extremely hilarious scenes. And she herself is a trip. I'm actually going to interview Catlin about her new book. It's going to be in Brooklyn on September 25th. And I'll put a link to that event on our show page as well. Amanda, what do you have?
I'm going to recommend an online feminist blog.
Whoa.
I know. Which is The Toast, which sort of feels like early online feminist blog to me, because it's like incredibly funny and it doesn't really care what other people are talking about. It's extremely irreverent and non-rhetorical. And so please go read The Toast. It's lovely.
Yeah, I agree. I greatly admire them. I wish they'd come up in our feminist blog conversation.
Oops.
That's okay.
They just did.
They just did came up. Well, thank you to Anne Haberman for recording and producing this podcast. Thank you to Andy Bowers, who is the executive producer of All the Slate podcasts. Thank you to our listeners. For more information about our show today, you can go to our show page at slate.com/XX. And for Noreen and Amanda, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
What's a man now? What's a man mean? Is he rough or is he rugged? Is he cultural and clean? Now it's all changed. It's got to change more, 'cause we think it's getting better, but nobody's really sure. And so it goes, go round again.
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.